Early in the morning, rise into the street. Light me up that cigarette, and I'll strap shoes on my feet. Got to find a reason, reason things went wrong. Got to find a reason why my money's all gone. I got a Dalmatian, I can still get high. I can play the guitar like on.
There we go. Ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to Drive Through HR. We had a wonderful show yesterday with Lorna Hagen from On Deck. So if you didn't listen live, please make sure to give that a listen sometime whenever you get a chance. It was just a wonderful show. But we're going to have her on. A lot of folks emailed me after the show. And we're going to try and have her on again in the next couple of months because she just had so much, you know, she's got 200 employees. She's got to hire another 150 this year and 200 next year. So, you know, she's got some interesting recruiting stories that we could all learn from. So we're going to back that up with a wonderful show with Ryan today. So, Ryan, how are you doing today?
Doing great. Doing great.
Awesome. Do us, do me, do the audience a favor and kind of tell us a little bit about yourself. Introduce yourself.
Sure. Ryan Ross. I've got responsibility for the Global Alliances practice at Hogan Assessment Systems. We're an international test publisher, work in the personality space, and use assessment tools to really take a deeper dive into driving strategic awareness, strategic self-awareness in organizations with employees, managers, from the top to the bottom of the organization. So my background is industrial organizational psychology, so won't bore you with all the details of that, but really looking at how do you apply the basic principles of using valid assessment tools to solve people problems.
I need to stop right there. And you used the word valid. How does the average HR recruiting professional know the difference between science, the real, you know, science, and, you know, y'all aren't the only one. There's a couple folks in the space that have real science, that have real valid stuff. And then a lot of this stuff that's newer, that might have science behind it, and, you know, it might not. It might just be all marketing. No slamming the market.
Yeah.
But how does the average practitioner separate the two?
You know, that's one of the hardest questions out there is for a practitioner, and it's something that we get asked all the time, not only with people trying to evaluate our tools, but just as a practicing, you know, as a practicing individual in the space, can you help us evaluate what we're being sold? And it goes back to, I think, a couple of fundamentals, and that is, does the organization that's trying to sell you an assessment product even know what validity means themselves? So is the organization able to come in and demonstrate beyond the fact that they took a sample of 20 people and gathered a one-item performance rating that says this was a good performer? Are they able to actually show that they've got historical data that supports the use of their assessments, that it actually predicts job performance across a wide variety of applications? Are they able to show that it doesn't discriminate against different types of individuals? You know, that's a hot topic these days, whether it be, you know, the NFL threatening to move a Super Bowl or whether it be, you know, class action lawsuits. Are you able to show the job relevance of an assessment tool? So there's a lot of different variables at play. Unfortunately, the assessment industry is an unregulated industry. Not that I'm advocating for the government to get involved, but to the degree at which they are, they're overwhelmed. And so really it does. It falls on the shoulder of the corporate buyer, of the corporate consumer, to dig in and really understand what does it mean to have valid, reliable assessment tools that predict performance, and to challenge the providers, to challenge the potential providers, to prove to them that they're able to predict performance, that they're able to show the valid impact that an assessment tool can have on whether it be their selection and or development processes.
Is one line of cutoff or one line of thinking for practitioners to a pure numbers game? You know, we've had 5 million people take this test, et cetera. Like, is that just, first of all, is that just wrong and we shouldn't do that? Or can it be as easy as that's one way to evaluate, and then you get to and then you can get to some other things?
No, I think sheer volume doesn't tell us anything. You know, you look at social media, which obviously you're an expert on, and the use of social media in HR. I could put a test up on Facebook tomorrow or launch something on Twitter tomorrow, and if I put the right name behind it, if I get the right, you know, buzzwords on it, I could have 1 million cases of data overnight if I take it globally. I could probably have 10 million cases of data by the end of the month. That doesn't make my assessment tool valid just because I have responses. What makes it valid is actually the theoretical construct of, as an example, does having a higher level of ambition in a salesperson drive sales revenue? And being able to show that from a correlational or from a statistical perspective that higher scores on something like ambition predict higher levels of sales success, so higher levels of revenue. And if you don't have those linkages between the outcome, what you're trying to achieve from a business performance perspective and a test score, then you don't have a valid measurement. You may be able to measure ambition, but if your measurement of ambition doesn't predict an outcome, then why are you testing people? That's why we always say assessment has a practical job to do, and that's to predict non-test performance. You know, it's to predict an outcome. It's to predict something that we really care about. And in the business world, that's business unit performance.
What is top of mind for you these days? What's keeping you and or your clients up at night?
You know, the one thing that we've been spending a lot of time, or my clients have been spending a lot of time thinking about, is their high potential programs or the word high potential. What, you know, what is this thing high potential? A lot of my clients are global. They've got operations in 15, 20 different countries, and they may or may not be centralized here in the U.S. in terms of this being their headquarters. And they're really starting to try to rethink this whole notion of high potentials and high potential programs. And it was really interesting. I had a great conversation about 2 months ago with a good friend of mine. His name's Adam Yearsley over at Red Bull. And Adam challenged a lot of my assumptions, and I have to say I actually have started to grab on to some of his trains of thoughts around some of the traditional things we've thought of about high potential models or high potential programs. And, you know, I think some of the challenges that our clients are facing is they identify talent pools, they identify high potentials in whatever way they do it, and we can debate the merits of how people identify high potential programs. And They think of it as a process. They think of it as we're developing people towards a role around these expectations. The challenge is their fill rates are so low. And, you know, David Ulrich's writing that fill rates are less than 20%. So here you have a group of high potential, say a group of 50, and less than 20% are actually making it to that next level. Why? Because senior leaders aren't leaving. There is no turnover at the top. So you're creating these expectations. You've got this unknown scenarios playing out at the top of the organization. So clients are starting to ask, what are we developing high potentials for? Is it a position? Is it a role? Is it a scenario? Or are we really just, should we be developing them to be better leaders in general, regardless of where they are in the organization? So I think what's really keeping us up at night, or what we're thinking about, what's top of mind is, what's the purpose of a high potential program? You know, what's the fundamental goal? Is it to develop bench strength, or is it to develop leaders? And does it matter where those leaders are deployed within the organization at any given point in time?
All right, let me ask a couple questions, probative questions around high potentials. Would is it been your experience that high potentials in one company, if we could take them out and drop them into another company, would they be high potentials in another company?
Great question. You know, it's really interesting. What the research shows is that senior managers or high potentials hired from the outside have about a 66% failure rate when they're transported into the new organization. That's research both that we've done and also that CCL has done. So the answer to that statistically is no. Bringing a high potential in from one organization to another, it's not any better than growing your own talent. And actually, the numbers from our growing our internal talents, not a lot better. There we see about a 48% failure rate for those that are grown internally. And I think that's just fundamentally because of the way we try to identify talent. And so, you know, with that, there's so many variables at play. There's the cultural variable. It's what made you good in one job doesn't necessarily make you good in another. And I think you can play those scenarios over and over again. I promise people here I wouldn't go into sports analogies, but you look no further than professional athletics. And I think that can teach us a lot about business, and taking one great player, putting them on a different team doesn't make that team great.
That's exactly right, and the Cowboys proved that year.
Cowboys proved that every season.
Every season, hey, we're good.
Knowing
like
that you're in Dallas, I wasn't going to go there, but you brought it up.
I live right by the stadium. I'm very comfortable with this. Mediocrity is commonplace here in Arlington, Texas. Do you see personality truisms across high potentials? Do you see things that just kind of bubble up across, like, not all, but most high potentials?
I think you do. You know, we tend to think that there's four or five key things, and in our research and in the research of others, there's four or five key characteristics that you're seeing across individuals that are being identified, and this is important, not by their boss as high potential, but by their peers and by their staff as high potentials. And it's a pretty easy list. First and foremost, people trust them. You know, they're rewarding to deal with. They're trustworthy. They're likable. Individuals are willing to go to battle with them. Second, obviously they're talented. You know, they're curious. They're adaptable. They're coachable. Third, they're hardworking and achievement oriented. So they're driven. They're competitive. You know, when things get tough, when the stress and pressure hits, they don't throw their hands up. They don't blame others. They don't you know, say that it's someone else's fault. They'll take responsibility. Fourth, we're finding a lot of people talk about resiliency and using good judgment around decision making. So it's not just that they make a decision, but they have good judgment. And so when they do make a bad decision, they're quick to say, "I made a mistake," and change direction. And then finally, we're hearing a lot from people around their successful high potentials that they have an entrepreneurial spirit. So bringing back some of that creativity, being opportunistic, having more of a vision and proactive nature about them. And all of those things boil down to inter and intrapersonal skills, so personality. Obviously, you've got to have people in that high potential group or your high potentials have got to be smart. They wouldn't be at the party. They wouldn't be on the dance floor if they weren't smart to begin with. You know, they wouldn't have made it to that level in the organization. But it's what differentiates people is their ability to, we feel like, really strive in those five areas.
Smart as in EQ or IQ or how would we define smart?
Yeah, for us in terms of my definition there, smart in terms of cognitive ability to do the job. EQ we could save for another discussion, because EQ is just personality. EQ was personality wrapped in a better wrapper and better packaging. It's stress tolerance and social skills. So
nice. So I have this belief that innovation comes from friction. And I want to get your take A on that, and so you can myth bust a little bit there. But also, how do we evaluate kind of that renegade, wildcatter kind of mentality or personality? You know, do we need those folks in an organization? You know, if so, do we need them as leaders? Like, you know, what do you think about when I say innovation comes from friction?
Oh, I think you've got to have friction. I think you have to have people that are willing to be somewhat disruptive. We have a great client and that one of their key attributes in their leadership model is disruptiveness. Now, it's not at the point of anarchy. It's not at the point of you know, really deviance in the traditional sense, but it's people that are willing to go against the grain. And they had some large issues that emerged in the early to mid-2000s where they had a bunch of groupthink. They had people that were unwilling to rock the boat. They had too many people that were too alike in their senior leadership team. And so there was a lot of consensus decision-making. So I think you do have to have people that are willing to be flexible. You have to have people that are willing to be somewhat disruptive. But they have to have the skills to do that in a respectful nature. And I think that's the challenge, is we're enamored by those that go in and are disruptive. The challenge is those individuals oftentimes don't have the social skills or, in traditional words, they don't have the EQ, if you will, to do it in a way that people will respect them and or keep them around long term. And that's one of the challenges we face with some of our high potentials that we see, is they're great for the organization, but will the organization tolerate them in the long term? The second thing with that is those people also are ones that we need to count on to develop future talent. And that's the other side of the coin of what our clients are talking about. Is there so much emphasis placed on high potentials in terms of developing their skill sets as future leaders, we tend to forget about, or it's the last thing on the list of what we should be teaching these people, is how to be talent identifiers themselves, or how to be talent coaches themselves. And so we almost expect them just to pick up how to identify and develop the next generation of talent behind them. And again, I think that's critical and key, especially when you look at the demographic gap. Doing a lot of work in Europe at the moment, and they have a wider demographic gap than we do. And so, you know, you think about the challenge of putting 25, 30-year-olds in senior executive-level positions. There's not a problem with that, but think about the next level of management and the next level below that. There isn't people with time in job and world experiences. They're having to learn as they go. And are we developing people quick enough to meet those global challenges?
Nice. I need you to do some more myth busting here. People still believe in the type A personality. And I mean, this is rampant in HR and recruiting in particular. So first of all, please bust that apart.
You mean the I'm the greatest person in the room mentality?
Yeah.
No, you're not, number one. Number two, I always say, you know, when someone says, oh, my staff loves me, oh, yeah, can I ask them in private? you know, no, I mean, the whole type A thing, you look at the whole notion of servant leadership, you look at the whole notion of leaders growing from within and engagement. You know, engagement is not about compliance. Engagement is about being committed to the goal. And I think if you look at all the research that's been done on engagement, Sirota has got some great research on engagement around different types of leadership styles. What you find is that command and control leader, their staff's not engaged. Their staff's doing it because they're afraid. And what happens over the course of time is you see the performance of those organizations begin to drop dramatically. And it's because people leave. They just won't tolerate it. And in today's age and with today's workforce and with the different generations coming into the workforce, they're sure not going to tolerate it.
All right, so I got two more that I really want to get to. One is, where should we look at personality? And what I mean by that is use cases of, is this pre-hire? Is it around team building? Obviously, we've talked about high performer or high potentials, et cetera. Where should we look at personality in an organization?
You know, and it's not just because I've been doing this for the last 20 years at Hogan, but the earlier the better, because it's once you get them on board, you've got them. And, you know, we bring our personalities to work with us every day. And it's whether we're going to hire the person, whether we're going to put them on a team, whether we're going to promote them, whether we're going to go let them talk to our best customers, or whether we're going to have to dismiss them because they can't get along with people in the office or they're disruptive. You talk to recruiters day in and day out, or you talk to line managers, and you ask them, think about the last 10 people you had to ask to leave your organization. What was it for? And what you'll find is that 90 to 95% of the time, they were not dismissed because they technically couldn't do the job. They were dismissed because of their inter or intrapersonal skills, i.e. their personality. And so it's critical. It's the critical building block in all of your HR activities. Organizations have become much more open to that. The last research study that I saw around utilization in the U.S. at least was that at least 70% of organizations are now using some sort of personality and or behavioral attribute assessment tools in their pre-hire process. And then obviously on the development side, it's higher even than that.
What's the relationship between personality and culture or culture fit?
You know, personality and culture, they're connected, but for us it's a slightly different. When we think about culture fit, we think more about personal values and drivers. And so it's more about your core beliefs and your core think about it as another layer. Personality is what we see on a daily basis. It's the you that we know, where your core values and drivers are the inside. It's the things that we don't necessarily see on the surface, but it's what on the underpinnings are what drives your behavior. So what you're after in life, and then the personality is what helps you get there. And what we know is that people will stick around and do the job, and they do the job well because of what we see on the surface, their everyday characteristics. But they won't necessarily stick with the company. And so we're seeing that in some of the generational research that we're doing, where key person culture fit variables are becoming more important. You know, they may be the best programmer in the world, but if they don't like the fact that you don't give them every Friday off, or they don't like the values of the company, they're willing to leave and go somewhere else. Where you take maybe my parents' generation, you know, 35 years at the same company, if you left, wow, you changed jobs, that's not a good thing. So they were a little bit maybe less flexible or more flexible, if you will, in terms of sticking it out even though the values didn't fit with those of the company.
So years ago, someone told me a story about using personality or personality assessments and really looking at safety or people that had in an environment where they had to deal with safety, and it was kind of a game of ruling people out of the position that just weren't hardwired to be safe,
mm-hmm.
Et cetera. So I want to get your take on clever uses of assessments that you've seen over the last 20 years. Where have you've always almost been shocked that people are like, yeah, I can see that now. Well, that's pretty cool. Like, what are some clever uses of assessments?
You know, there's a lot of different applications, and that's some of the innovative things that we've been doing outside of just your traditional application, whether it be, and we have a whole safety solution, speaking of safety, but the whole safety application, some of the really cool things are working in some of the healthcare applications of looking at patient adherence to treatment, and do different personality characteristics drive different treatment protocols based on reward structures, based on values? Are there different ways to look at personality-based research and investment risks? So some of our partners in Europe are looking at it from a advisor and investor relationship, and can I work better with my financial planner based on our personality styles and our values? So a lot of different applications, because again, it comes down to communication, it comes down to human interaction. You know, outside of Hogan, you know, why do you think the key dating sites have been so successful? They use a version of personality to match people. Again, it's looking at commonalities. It's looking at key differences. Where are there attractions, and where are there such dissimilarities that, you know, we just don't want to put these two people together. And that goes back to the corporate world of how do you put together a high-performing team? You know, where do we need differentiators, and where can we not have such great gaps on certain dimensions to where we're just constantly going to have a battle on our hands.
What do you think the future of personality or personality assessments, what do you think it looks like?
You know, I think there's a couple of things. One is there's going to be a point in time where from a commercial or from a corporate perspective, from an HR perspective, that our buyers and the corporate world says to the industry, police yourself. That there's going to be enough trying and enough playing around with something that looks good but doesn't work, that the industry is going to have to say enough's enough with the overnight new assessment that looks fun, that's exciting, that's flashy but doesn't do anything. So one, I think that's a future development, is there's going to have to be some focus on, or heavier focus on, quality. Second, I think from a personality perspective, people are going to be more interested in mapping out career pathing. I think there's going to be a lot more focus on, we're hiring this individual today based on their desire to grow and develop. How can we fast track that? Especially with some of the things we're seeing in Asia and India, with the demand for employees, with the demand for leaders and for accelerated learning. So not having 4, 5, 6 years to work in an organization, but rather at the 18-month interval now having a staff of 15 or 20 people. So trying to accelerate things based on who they are and really focusing in on development. I think the third is integrating across different programs that are typically seen in organizations. So not just thinking of using assessment just for selection, but how do we take that same selection information that we gathered on an individual, move that into an onboarding program, a new hire orientation, straight into development. So instead of it being encapsulated in, this is recruitment, oh, now we're going to go assess you in the OD department, and then we have HR business partners, starting to really see a trend for sharing data across lines and across the organization, just from an efficiency standpoint. So I think there's some trends there that we're definitely starting to pick up on, and I think it's good for everyone, and it'll continue to make sure you've got the best measurement available across the globe.
So last question, we got about 2.5 minutes left. I want to get, you do work all around the world, and you've traveled the world. What are some of the differences that you've seen in terms of personality as you kind of brought this to market? What are some of the differences that you see from a personality perspective?
You know, I think what we see is not necessarily a difference in traditional characteristics of people. What we tend to see a difference in is what is culturally acceptable in different parts of the world. And the classic example that I use is when we think about something like the concept of interpersonal sensitivity or agreeableness and the way that we interact with people. You know, I take someone, say, that's based in Paris, and I take somebody who's based in Shanghai. I'm trying to sell them a product or a service. You know, I make the presentation in Paris. I know the individual has a low score on this concept of interpersonal sensitivity. They don't want to buy it. They're going to look me straight in the eyes, and they're going to say, no, I don't want it. Goodbye. I do the same thing in Shanghai. In Shanghai, the person looks at me and says, maybe, we'll see, perhaps. That's two completely different messages, isn't it? But yet it's the same characteristic, and it's playing out the same way, but culturally we have some differences in what's acceptable in terms of how that characteristic plays out. And that's one of the nuances that, you know, back to your very first question about, you know, from a differentiator and from a testing professional's advice to practitioners, you better make sure that whatever you're using, that your provider understands and has factored in that cultural sensitivity into their assessment tools. But those are some of the interesting things, is just the nuances of what's culturally relevant and culturally significant based on where you are in the world, number one. Number two is just the sensitivity to some of the topics and the social acceptance of conversing about some of these topics. You know, and it's interesting as a Westerner thinking that going to some parts of Asia, oh, we just can't do this as part of a team building workshop because, you know, people will be overly sensitive to it. And getting there, and that's the first thing they want to do. And so it's really interesting about having to check your preconceived ideas at the door and really understanding that local culture that you're working in. And I think that's one of the biggest mistakes that we make, both corporately and then also from a consulting perspective, is, you know, reading things on Wikipedia about cultures and or just taking what we think we've gathered versus really diving in and experiencing it firsthand.
Yeah. Well, brother, we are out of time. 30 minutes, it rolls by on Drive Through HR. Well, thanks again for coming on. I absolutely appreciate it. Absolutely love what y'all do. And we're going to roll out to a little audio slave. Awesome. Ryan, have a wonderful afternoon, and we'll talk soon.